Tonight, I am so happy to have Minerva Cuevas, a conceptual artist based in Mexico City, here to share her practice as a resourceful and inspired socially engaged artist. Mexico City is Minerva's base, but generating projects in response to politically charged contexts, her work takes her to locations across the globe. Regularly invited to participate in institutional and artist projects and awarded artist residencies, Minerva has traveled the world with residencies from the Museum of World Cultures in Frankfurt to the Banff Center for the Arts in Alberta, Canada, just to name a couple. In 2003, she was selected for the prestigious DAAD Artist Residency in Berlin. And recent international solo exhibitions include shows at the Museum of the City of Mexico and the Curie Mazzuto Gallery in Mexico City, Whitechapel Gallery in London, the Van Abe Museum and, in Indhoven, and the Kunsthal Basel in Basel. She has also been included in significant group exhibitions that span the globe, such as at the Guggenheim in New York, the Modern Art Museum of Paris, the Centre Pompidou in Paris, and the KW Institute for Contemporary Art in Berlin, and then, of course, Minerva Cuevas was one of the artists featured in this museum's exhibition, Mexico Inside Out, but she was also most recently in the DMA's exhibition of Mexican art. And unfortunately, the title of that exhibition is escaping me. Does anybody? I think many of you saw it because I think, in fact, some of you were perhaps introduced to her work with that exhibition. Always concerned about people having agency and access, Minerva founded the Better Life Corporation in 1998 and the International Understanding Foundation in 2016. So it's clear that we're going to love her, right? This evening, Minerva is here to bring together the results of her travels, intellectual pursuits, and socially charged endeavors in a practice that seeks to make a difference. If you would, please join me in welcoming Minerva Cuevas.
Thank you all for being here. Thank you very much, Terry, for the invitation. It's very special. Well, I'll go through many different projects, and I decided to start with the microscopic world. This is called the Bioremediation Project, and it's an invitation I rejected twice because there was this initiative in Mexico to do an art project connected to all the garbage in the city. And they were asking us to propose projects that would really make an impact on what was happening with all the trash. And I thought any art project wouldn't have an impact on that serious situation. For me, it was like if they were asking me to do something in connection to poverty in the city, it sounded just impossible. So I rejected the invitation twice, but they said it was that criticism that was interesting for them. It was the National University and the galleries as part of the university, and also the Goethe Institute from Germany who were producing the project and inviting German and Mexican artists to develop it. So at the end, I kind of got convinced and forced me a little bit to think about something that could be a permanent influence on the problem. But first of all, I didn't see the garbage as the problem. I understood that the problem, in fact, was the packaging industry and all capitalist systems in connection to the production of goods. So for me, the best way to approach this was through research and the university itself. So, well, here you have a description of what is a bioremediation. And I knew that a very young student had done experiments in connection to bacteria that could eat plastic and destroy plastic, especially the plastic used for bags. So I started fantasizing about this large experiment and destroying all the plastic in the world. Now I had like this super bacteria in mind. Mm-hmm. And of course I invited researchers to join me. And we went to the largest landfill in the galaxy that used to be in Mexico City. When I step on this landfill, I realize what capitalism means, because it was a large area with garbage classified by year. So you had different kind of biological processes. At some point, you could feel all the heat generated by the bacteria in the land. So we went there in search for the bacteria that destroys plastic. We took samples, and we managed to get a collection of bacteria. That's the handsome bacteria we found. And I collaborated with a geologist and a chemist. This is called, in fact, a consortium of bacteria. So it's not that only one destroys or eats plastic, but it's a series of them that can destroy plastic. And the chemist mentioned that we could even work with only the genetic information of this bacteria to develop an experiment. And, well, at the end, the research and exhibition happened in a gallery space, also part of the university. Here you have the live bacteria, but the important part is that all the research connected to this state as part of the university archives, and they could continue with the project and the research. The other interesting part of it is that what happens with the energy of the chemical processes of the bacteria, that potentially could also mean alternative energy. This is another project also produced in Mexico. I was invited to develop an artwork connected to climate change. And many of my works connect to ecology, and especially social ecology, because I think that any ecological crisis has to do always with the social crisis we are experiencing. So in this case, I knew that one of the consequences of climate change is connected to the destruction of coral reef. And in Mexico, we have one part of something called the Mesoamerican coral reef, which is the largest in the world after the Australian one. So I decided to go and see for myself what kind of damage has been caused by climate change in that area. And also decided to do an underwater demonstration, which sounds good, but I needed to get certified as a diver, and I had no idea about diving. I'd never been ever underwater like that. So you have the coral reef, I don't know, in feet, but it's 20 meters below the surface. And I got certified in 4 days, and we had to film in 2 days. So it was challenging, but at the end it was possible. And the main objective was to do this underwater demonstration with the statistics or the percentages of coral reef left in the world which is less than 1%, and also the percentage of species that depend on that amount of coral reef, which is 25%. And there are more species living underwater than on the surface of Earth. So it's a big problem, a great crisis, and we are not that aware because somehow it's like under there and we see the horizon but not the underwater world. So it was part of the exercise I wanted to do, go and see for myself what was the situation. Another of the banners was that one. It translates as everything is common, because that's one of the problems, that if something changes underwater, it doesn't affect only the communities that are on the coast and depend on that environment, but it affects all of us. And we are not aware of how serious is the problem underwater. As part of my work, I use a lot of graphics. I exploit graphics, you have no idea, with brands, with corporate image a lot. Some things are very well known, others not so much, like this collage. For me, media at the moment equals power. And advertising has been also very interesting for me to analyze. And the National Geographic magazine, it's a great example of the evolution, not only of the kind of information that is connected to mass media research on culture, but also ecology, plus the advertising. For me, it's interesting to see how the National Geographic has been advertising watches, flights, cars, at the same time with ecological issues. And, well, now that I mention advertising, this is a good example of how I use graphics to channel information. I think what is important for me is to use our image bank. We all have all the advertising and branding as part of our systems already. Our image bank is huge. Once we see something, we cannot erase it voluntarily. And for me, that's one of the ways I can somehow provoke a different reading or an intellectual process. And well, in this case, changing Evian for Egalité was very much commenting on the multicultural aspects of French society, also because the brand is presenting the national French colors, the blue, the red, the white, and, well, it says natural condition equality. So it very much comments on French multiculturalism more than water. I mean, anyone can read the alteration or the graphic through their own filters. I'm totally aware of that. But in this case, it was a response to the French political system at the moment. And whenever I alter a graphic or corporate image, it usually is part of a campaign. It doesn't stay only as a graphic. So on the right-hand side, you can see how water bottles were distributed in a museum space. We produced, I think, 50,000 water bottles, and they were for free. On the left-hand side, it's a student from the Rennes University that asked me to borrow the graphic to produce banners and use them in demonstrations when the right wing emerged more evidently in France with Le Pen. And, well, for me, that's the best that can happen with one of my works. No, I didn't produce it, I didn't document it, they just ask to borrow the design. They didn't even have to ask, but the result was my favorite. In the case of the water bottles, something I didn't predict was that the graphic exercise was going to appear in many public spaces, because then you started seeing the water bottle in parks, in transportation. Children were carrying it around parks because, well, they were for free and they got spread around the city. So usually, the graphic works become campaigns. That's another graphic solution that was part of the Sao Paulo Biennial. And in that case, it was a very large mural painting, but it was graffiti artists who helped me painting it. And the whole research was based on site, and it started with a kind of portrait of the Amazons and the companies that are exploiting the natural resources there. So the black elements are connected to the companies that are either exploiting cellulose or soybeans in the area. The airplane was a comment on the economy, because at that time, Barrick, the main airline, got bankrupt. So the lamp I'm using there, it's part of the Barrick airline logo. And signifies the economic crisis. On the right-hand side, you can see Brasilia that was also planned in the shape of an airplane. So there were references to urbanization, also the military, the Indians that having expelled of their land by the same companies. That's another example of how I also intervene public spaces in Mexico. This is, it used to be a fun fair in Mexico City, right in the middle of the city and right beside two main avenues, Patriotism and Revolución. And you had traffic coming and going all around. And these are electric cars. And when I planned to do this intervention, it was a time when there were articles about this new pipeline, the Alaskan pipeline, and I decided to, basically just put the main oil companies' logos on the cards, and the comment is very basic. They are all the time crashing with each other and fighting for territories, and those were for free during 2 weeks. And well, I thought about it as a temporary intervention, but the owners of the funfair left the logos on the cars, and it stayed for 8 years until until the fair disappeared because of the gentrification process. Now it's buildings in that site, but it was planned as a temporary intervention. And that's a continuation of how I did research on the oil industry. In fact, I was interested on what had happened with a big meteorite that fell in Yucatan in the southeast of Mexico. And I realized that there was no interest on the archaeology of the site and what had happened with this huge meteorite that meant to kill all the dinosaurs. We are guilty of that. The thing is that they wanted to find oil in the area, and that's why they found this site where the meteorite fell. So I went to the main cities where oil is extracted in Mexico, mainly Ciudad del Carmen. So the city is totally dedicated to work for Pemex, the national oil company. And when I was there, I also witness that there was this 2 months fire in one of the platforms. There was an accident, and also all the newspapers were talking about that fire. So I decided to build this installation based on that kind of research. The photographs you see there are part of the daily life of the workers of the platforms, because no one can approach those areas. It's high security areas, so the workers take their own photos and then they sell those in the market as postcards. So for me, it was a treasure to found those. There's nothing in that city apart from the oil industry and the monument to the shrimp in the middle of the city, nothing else. But at the end, everything got together to make comments also about marine exploration, the American interest also in the area, and other references to classic ecology. And for me, it was also very important to work with tar as material and very much connecting it to the pre-Hispanic use of tar, which was covering stone sculptures and other uses. I mean, they even use it as a medical element, I think even as tooth fillings, just to fix dental problems. Here you have one of the first paintings I did in tar, and it was the beginning of a series of paintings. I produce it like this, and the connection to, in this case, the Popocatépetl volcano is that the main person that made possible the commercial oil extraction in Mexico was a geologist, Ezequiel Ordóñez. He used to write about the volcanoes, the Popocatépetl and the Iztaccíhuatl, and his work was very much academic. And then Shell and other companies were interested in extracting oil in Mexico and were not able to find where to exactly have the, how you call them, the drilling or the sites. They couldn't find those. So at the end, it was a geologist, Ezequiel Ordóñez, who made that possible, because he knew so well the orography of Mexico that he was the only person that could inform them about that. And, this image is part of one of my favorite projects that, in fact, took place in Texas. And it's called Crossing the Rio Bravo. And I was invited to do a project for MARFA. And, I decided I wanted to, of course, produce something that could connect both the U.S. and Mexico. So my initial ideas were very much about the concept of bridge, building a bridge or somehow generating a bridge. I have worked in the past with communications like radio and mobile phone autonomous communications. So I thought, well, maybe a free phone connecting both sides or an accident, probably a tree falling or several trees falling over the river, but I had never been in the river area. And finally, I could travel there through Juarez, El Paso, and then go to MARFA, and then someone took me to the area of the Rio Grande, the Rio Bravo, and I realized it was not one river, it was many different rivers, and historically, the border, it's not only the river, but the deepest part of the river. And it was under a canyon. It was dry. It could split in two. So little by little, the concept of border was abstract. There was no border, and there were no signs. There were border patrols now and then, but I realized, okay, the most powerful thing here is not surveillance, it's not a limit, but the desert itself, the environment. And I found a site like this and decided to use the rocks to mark which way you could cross from one side to the other and build the bridge in this way. It was limestone, so natural material also. And stop there. So I ended up marking this dotted line between the U.S. and Mexico, and ended up crossing from the U.S. to Mexico and back. I only had a ziplock with my passport, and that was it. The water was up to my belly button, and there were three people with me. Also, we did another artwork in the area, but one was mainly guiding us, another one taking the photographic documentation, and they were American, and they also said that they felt liberated while I was crossing, because even for them, it was illegal to step inside the river. So for me, it was liberating from the political imaginary connected to the border. Again, no, all this violence and surveillance and control, it was not there. And that was really important. I mean, not only as an artwork, but experiencing it as a person, it was really valuable. So after this action or experience, I also had some relics from the area and decided to build an installation work. And there you see a slideshow of how I'm painting and crossing the Rio Bravo River. You have also elements that relate to the river books. Also, the walking stick was important because I considered that the piece was also connected to the concept of walking as a political activity. I mean, there was nothing more political on that geographical area than walking from south to north. That was it. And I've been also exploring that in connection to public demonstrations. I have a studio space in Mexico City in the historical center, and there can be four demonstrations every day. And you start wondering, is it effective? Is it still meaningful to go to the streets and demonstrate? I think it is. There is a very special energy that is impossible to generate in any other way, but in this case, also walking as a political act was a main part of the action. I collected also rocks. You see also a little bit of a flask with the river water, flowers, also the disposed cans by immigrants that I could find, maps of the area. I even found a National Geographic magazine also talking about this specific area with this shocking image of someone closing the gate of the United States. I think it's from the 70s, the magazine, but it has been really valuable for some projects. And, well, now that I mentioned immigration, this other project happened in Europe, in Spain. And there, as I was asked to develop a public art project, I went around a neighborhood called Lavapies, and it's a very multicultural neighborhood, but I also noticed that it was under this gentrification process. So most of the people living there, these musicians, for example, they would go to other areas of the city to play as buskers and ask only tips. I decided to organize a concert for the neighborhood, but then I have to gather them back there. So I distributed flyers and posters inviting musicians of any nationality that would play any kind of music to join the concert for the neighborhood, and they were going to be paid as musicians for the concert. They had to play only half an hour, and they had to play what they usually play at the same time, and they didn't do any rehearsal. No one was directing them, and I thought, okay, it's going to be orchestral noise, but they'll be together. But what happened is that when they got together and started playing, they found this common rhythm. And, I mean, if I were a musician, probably I could have guessed that they were going to find this harmony and communication. But, that's, I guess, what happens with art projects like this. I'm not a musician, I'm not a sociologist, but I can put these elements together and then something happens. It's very much a cultural experiment. So what happened is, they found harmony and communication, even though they were also from many different nationalities. And at the back, there was even an invented instrument by some artist, some punk group also playing accordions, solo musicians, samba, all kinds of rumba and they played together, and they didn't play half an hour. They played for 1 hour because they were enjoying. The people from the neighborhood also came out of their places and danced a bit when the Cuban song was a little bit more evident. That was good already. But 2 years after this happened, the organizers of the exhibition told me that they knew that some of these musicians had gathered again and played another concert totally independently from that original organization. So again, it's the best that can happen with a project like this, and it's totally unpredictable. So yeah, now we are in the International Understanding Foundation that also... it's linked to this desire to bring people together through culture and just develop a language that could oppose racism and, in general, to bring people together through culture. In this case, the first exercise happened in Germany, in Cologne, at the Ludwig Museum. It was their 40th anniversary, so they invited artists to respond to the collection they have. They have one of the largest Picasso's collection. It's a vast collection. And there, what I wanted to do is research the archives of the museum. And I learned that, they have all these files about the public response to some artworks. And one of the most controversial was the Mondrian, the only Mondrian they own. Was very problematic to be part of the collection because it was expensive at the time when they bought it. So you got all this public reaction about the price and why buying something that expensive. So they have this big file. They have others that are connected to probably religious content, etc. So that was very interesting for me, and I decided to use that only Mondrian as a kind of floor plan for a structure. So you see on the right-hand side how we plan to use the original Mondrian to build the structure that was going to host all these other artworks. Also responding to the collection, like, well, the blue area included a sculpture of mine, also related to an Andy Warhol painting, one of the catastrophe paintings. So I found the original article that Andy Warhol saw to produce the painting, and for me it was also a connection to how he used social and cultural events as part of his work, and somehow at the end the context was reflected on his own work. On the right-hand side there you see a Mexican mask that was for me shocking that it's so minimal. I mean, there is no color, it's just like that, black. But it reminded me of a group in Cologne called the Cologne Progressives that produce all those kind of graphics, all of them connected to social and political issues. And in fact, they are the base of the modern or the contemporary graphic image. All the infographics that are developed nowadays, the simple icons come from that kind of graphic example. And well, for me, both things had a lot to do, and I wanted to comment on the Cologne Progressives. And another great thing to find was this photograph of a rock band in the 80s, also using the Cologne Progressives graphics on the left-hand side. What they are using as a banner is this early graphic from the 20s. So for me, that was another proof of how something that is part of the art context or part of culture can influence and live through different generations. But yeah, it was very special to see first the paintings in the museum, then the graphics that are based of the contemporary graphics now, and also seeing that someone in the 80s, a punk rock band, used it. And, well, this is a very new research project. I'm invited to the San Francisco MoMA and the Cadist Foundation in San Francisco to develop a project in connection to public knowledge. And when I started thinking about public knowledge, I immediately thought that probably fire was this early knowledge that is the origin to all civilization. And then also thought, okay, it's an interesting combination, fire and libraries, because the project is meant to happen in all the San Francisco public libraries. It's huge because they have 7 million visitors a year. So for me, that's also an ideal situation, the best context to produce an artwork or an intervention. So yeah, I started playing with the idea of fire and how much it's so opposed to the idea of libraries and then book burning as this political historical fact, to using fire as part of social protest, that everything started to come together. And I found that even the public libraries had fire in their original logo. So they have the phoenix, but also fire, because San Francisco is a city that also has suffered a lot from fires, and the whole city has been transformed through the fires there. So it became really complex, and then many other elements came together, like the historical photographs of the fires there. What I want to do is intervene not only the bookshelves in the libraries, but also probably generate some kind of bookmarks in the city that tell you about what has happened or how the city was transformed through the fires there. So again, I'm fantasizing with this intervention on the bookshelves, but probably also a TV show, some kind of TV-style production that can present interviews about public knowledge, about the life in libraries. Listening to the librarians was very interesting because I learned many anecdotes, but also it made me think about how books have been censored, and they mentioned that they have users that, one, for example, a man that used to cut the books censoring any gay or homosexual related content from them, and they organized and they cut him, and they managed to get what he was just hiding, the paper cuts under the tables. They managed to cut him, but then later they organized an exhibition with all the cutouts of the censored books, and that's the best solution ever. So I'm really trusting the librarians to give me more feedback. They talk about a man that goes there with his iguana, as how you call the animals that you can carry like around. Well, it's an iguana, it's not a dog. He goes as emotional support. But those kind of stories, it's for me research. For me, research doesn't mean Googling. It doesn't mean going through bibliography. It means I need to talk with someone from the local context and get this information through them, and also I'm trusting them as the filter of information. So for me, it's essential to go and meet someone that is familiar with the context and that will give me his view and his feedback and filter so much the context for me. And well, that's the presentation. Thank you very much. That's my contact if you need it. Yes, I think that's the most important part of the talk. So please ask some questions.
I was just saying to my friend here, I was really glad you spoke about what you think of as research at the end of your talk. And I'm actually finding myself hungry for more, the way you think about research and frame it for these projects, because it must also change the nature of the project. So San Francisco versus the reefs, you know, garbage, biomedical. So I'm curious if you could just expand a little bit more about how you think through research and your process.
Yes, I think even though I have a very personal political position, I tend to avoid having closed statements. There is, of course, a point of view, but usually the artwork is final when there is this intellectual process. And that's why I mean why I say that my work is research, because it's not projects that you can recognize as being solved with a very specific formal solution. It's not that I only produce mural paintings or special kind of graphics. No, it's the research what connects all of them. No, even though there are some that doesn't seem develop in the same way, like the Better Life Corporation, these interventions in urban spaces. They started in Mexico City distributing free subway tickets or lowering the price in supermarkets, just changing the barcode. These interventions were the starting point for developing the graphic campaigns, and they connect, for example, to the Rio Grande, the Rio Bravo project, through probably the same intention of finding this freedom gap where you can still exercise some agency, and just realizing that it's possible to make a student ID card that is not fake. It's part of my project. I say you are student, part of my project, and then you can use it for discounts, etc. That's a strategy. But it's so similar to, oh, let's go to the river and see how is it. It's the same kind of mechanism there. And in those cases, again, being confronted to the context, it's what triggers this research exercise. It's witnessing, but it's also very much connected to intuition. And I sometimes call it the human interface. And it's this filter, no? It's like, if I want to learn about Texas, Fort Worth, I'll ask you. No, I won't trust Google at all. No, Google is another kind of filter. So I would ask you. And that's what I mean with research. And, that's what I also try to push a little bit when I'm invited to produce new work. Is like, yes, but I need to do research. And that means meeting the right kind of people. And that's also the best part of the production of the projects, meeting the best people in the world. For me, that's not only part of my own education. I mean, at the end, more than making statements, it's also a learning process. And yeah, it's so enjoyable. Thank you.
You mentioned walking, and I forgot what you said about it, but I'm interested in hearing more about your thoughts on walking.
Yes, I think before the Rio Bravo project, I started wondering how much the demonstrations are generating an impact, a political impact. And we have so many in Mexico City that I wish I could somehow prove that they work. What was that kind of special energy generated. But then I learned about other groups also using walking as a political tool. And I think for the Situationist, it was also a main element in their practice. So little by little, I connected those things. But probably in the case of the Rio Bravo project, thinking about all the immigration going through that area, and not only human immigration. I think I'm more concerned about what would happen with a wall or a fence or any limit to the animals having to move from one climate to the other, because that's their natural way to survive, know what's happening to them. I mean, human trafficking is going to continue, drug trafficking is going to continue. But yeah, I'm more concerned to what's happening with all the natural movement and transit in those areas. So it's part of that. But yeah, I started thinking about that, seeing the context of Mexico City and seeing how also people from other states of the country had to go to Mexico City and demonstrate there, because it's the political stage. No? The Zócalo in Mexico City, it's where you have to be. If not, you are not seen. And that involves walking, and that involves seeing people that has never been in a urban environment. No, it's indigenous people that see the Fine Arts Palace for the first time. No, and you see how their faces are like just turning around the city, and they are shocked and mesmerized, and it's interesting. So I do think that demonstrations are the only way to gather this human energy and see that you are there in community with the other. You don't have to agree. Almost no one would agree in such a large group of people, but the energy generated, I think it's unique. And I don't see in which other way that could be made or generated. Yeah.
So how do you reconcile your place in this process of research and the impact of the statements that are generated from this research? I know you've talked about the resistance to starting the garbage project because it didn't sort of satisfy the results that you could get making an artwork around that sort of massive project. Do you find yourself how do you place yourself in that space? Because on the one hand, it almost seems like even walking or protesting or making something out of the research feels futile in the face of the gravity or the enormity of any situation, but then it also feels necessary to produce the work that comes out of that research.
Let me see. I think there is a big difference between an art project and an activist action, and it's very common to mix both of them with the contemporary practices or how much graphic or artistic elements we can see in activism, you know, from Greenpeace to the women's demonstration. I mean, they are creative as well. But I think with political activism, there is a way to measure results. And what happened with the aesthetic practices or exercises is that there is no real way to measure them, and that's part of the freedom. And I think I mentioned it with the project in Madrid with the musicians. No, it was putting together elements that a musician was not going to do and a sociologist was not going to do, and it could only happen within the context of the contemporary art practice. And also, we cannot predict the results. I had no thesis to prove. And it was an amazing result that they got together again after 2 years and played another concert. So if that can't happen through a different practice, I don't know. But I think only through contemporary art is possible. And that's what I mean with this I think, clear political position from my side, but avoiding closed statements. No, I'm always trusting the audience to use their own filters and process the graphic and the information elements as part of the works, and then produce their own final work. No, so I think the research, the aesthetic elements, and the audience work at the same level. So I don't have a very specific formal solution for the works. No, it gets developed depending also of who's going to see it or approach it. They're having times when they ask me for a performance piece, and the first thing I develop is a graphic, and it's like, okay, now how do I translate it? But all the time it's this constant translation from research to the visual elements, or the finding this gap of freedom and exercising something that can enhance that. Or yeah, it's, I think that's very much how I understand research, and also taking a position without taking or closing the statement. Thank you.
How did your life lead you to this work?
Both of my parents are primary school teachers, and probably it started from there, even though they didn't want to decide for me like which career I was going to take. They were an influence. My father is more politically oriented and very socially engaged. So probably from that kind of background, I got my interest in social and political issues. But when I started producing art, or when I started deciding which career I was going to follow, it crossed my mind studying literature or philosophy, and it had nothing to do with social or political work. But at some point, it was logical to just mix those interests and or put them together. And then from that point, my practice became just more enjoyable, and it was flowing much better. Yes. Thank you.
Have you ever been in trouble or felt threatened by any corporations or entities because of the work that you do?
No, but, there have been some situations. I have an action using Ronald McDonald, the character. I'll tell you first about that action. I produced this work for the first time in Paris, and the museum, the Palais de Tokyo, found an actor that could learn all the information I had about the unethical practices about McDonald's, including the chemicals in the food, the labor issues, the links with the military, how much property they own in the world. I think after the Vatican, they are the second owner of real estate in the world. Those kind of things. So he was dressed very much as Ronald, and with some alterations in the costume. But he was not protesting outside the restaurant. He was inviting people to go inside the restaurant and eat there, but at the same time he was being very honest about the kind of food they were going to eat, and nothing happened. But then when I used that image, the photograph of this Ronald McDonald as part of an invitation card for another show in Mexico City, the public relations company that was working for McDonald's contacted me, and they said they wanted to invite me for breakfast or lunch. And I said, okay, that's assassination attempt, something like that. But I was really busy with the show. There, it was a solo show with more than 20 projects at the same time. And they wanted to meet me in a very specific restaurant, a very specific time, and it was just impossible. I said, that's strange. But the thing is that when I was 15 years old, I worked for a McDonald's. That was my first job ever. Because you couldn't get any other kind of job almost in Mexico at that age. So I knew everything about the restaurant, in fact, no, from the fryers to the freezers, you name it. I knew everything. So I just ignored them, and they didn't get back to me. But that was one time. And I think in general, well, what happens within the art context usually doesn't reach much of the larger society or where the corporations operate until now. It's happening more and more. But I think I would use the information that is part of the works as also a kind of potential statement. No, if they react, I'll also react saying, okay, this is public information that I'm reproducing and translating into an artwork, because that's a key thing. No, all the facts that are connected to those kind of actions, having already published by journalists or very well-known magazines. So yeah, I would use it as an opportunity to make the information more visible, because it has happened like that in the past with some activists doing that. There are very big examples about that. But in general, nothing has happened. One bank in Mexico City reacted to one of the shows because they lent furniture. It's so hard without seeing the images, but this Spanish bank lent some furniture, but also they lent the big mascot costume that is in fact a pig dressed as Robin Hood. I thought it's perfect. It's a bank using the pig, which is the symbol of greed and accumulation, as their mascot. This is ideal. I didn't do anything. I just put them in the museum. And they were glad because they didn't have to put any money. They were just lending old furniture and the mascot, and it was like, okay, free advertising for us in this big museum. And at the end, they decided to take the pigs away from the exhibition because they realized, okay, maybe this is not the ideal context. They knew about the whole project. They got a dossier with the plan for the exhibition and all the elements. They just thought it was free advertising, and they lent the pigs and the furniture. They took the pigs, they left the furniture. But that was great situation at the end, because I mean, we were used to religious censorship or political censorship or sexual censorship, but not corporate censorship. And it was the first case in the Mexican cultural context that something like that took place. No? So the bank complaining about the museum, and the museum saying, well, we show you. It was so flattering. It was so flattering. So it was the best that could happen. Thank you.
Thank you. How are we? That was lovely. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.